All right, it's okay, it's cool, I'm sure it's all right.
Yeah.
Looks a bit like a, you know, faulty penis, maybe not. Okay. Right, okay, okay. Sorry, went phallic. Right, okay, a limp. Should give it some Viagra. But, my name's Mark, and I'm an addict. And it's really good, and I am so fucking, I'm so nervous, you know, and it's torture. It's actually torture sitting here. I all the way through Yasmin's share, and also Yasmin, you shared so great, and the more Yasmin was getting emotional, I was thinking, God, she's done a great share. How are you going to compete with that, man? The fucking addict, man. It's like, and as Anthony says, it's like living with a flatmate who never goes out. The addict's always, it's always there, isn't it? It's such a fucking beast, really, that lives within our heads. And where do we start? I mean, I often think, like, I mean, I really want to give a sort of really positive message about, you know, the recovery, because I'm 20 years, I've stayed clean, and, you know, it's great. And what I've always done is I've always been really involved in the fellowship right from the beginning. This is really important for newcomers, and, you know, and you touched on it, Yasmin, around, you know, getting the it says in our literature, isn't it, is one thing it will defeat is in the recovery. This is an attitude of indifference towards spiritual principles. Three of these that are indispensable are honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. With these, we're well on our way. So they're indispensable. That means we cannot fucking do without them. We need, you know, to swear. I thought, because Yasmin's already started swearing, I thought, I may as well jump on the bandwagon. But so as soon as she swore, I thought, yes, I can swear now. But I've also, an American friend, he says, it's like I always came to the front of the... They say in New York especially, they say, the back's death row and the front's intensive care. So I've always been like, I've always been right in the front and involved and see everybody scurrying from the back now. Fucking hell, get to the front, you know what I mean? But anyway, I just... Really, there's so much I wanted to, like, cover, and I've got some really... And I look around this room, and I know so many people, and I love so many people in this room. And that's the thing, you know, coming from addiction, where it's a desolate wasteland, isn't it? It's just, like, it's barren, you know? And I've got, like, Barney's a friend who has sponsored for a while, we used to use, where Sonny's across here. And I'll tell you a story about Sonny, me and Sonny's experience, and... which goes away back when I was 25. I was drug dealing. I was always drug dealing really from quite a young age, and I had a 25th birthday party, and at the 25th party it was like a drug dealers convention. It was all these and travellers and a whole assortment. I had some INLA people there who were involved, and it was just a nutty concoction, wasn't it, Sonny, of different people, right? And the drug dealer came and he was given heroin. And my friend, my best friend at the time, it's a sad story, and it is the reality of addiction. He was like badgering this drug dealer all the time through the party. He was like, and I was like smoking crack. I was like, I'd washed up all this coke. It wasn't a crack, it was like freebase. So I'd washed up this crack and I kept going upstairs and smoking a pipe and then coming back and then drinking some wine and tequila and then coming back down. Anyway, the long and short of it, this drug dealer gave my friend some heroin. He gave him the spoon that he usually cooks up on, but he cooked up a lot of heroin, you know, and so the spoon was, you know, really good. The filters were really good, and so we used to always want his filters. It's like, I mean, this is for the heroin addicts in the room. Like, I mean, filters were really important. But anyway, my friend was badgering him, going. And I was really paranoid because I had these INL, like, I had these friends that I was selling loads of dope for, and they were like heavy duty sort of INLA, like, fucking, we hate heroin, we like cocaine, we like dope, and we like selling lots of acid as well, but we hate heroin. And so I was like really paranoid that these groups of people would meet each other, like, you know, like, and I was trying to keep them all in separate rooms. I mean, it's like, that's what it's like, isn't it? You're like such a chameleon when in the using, you're like fucking, you've different masks for different people. And And but the long and short of it, he got the spoon, he got the fault, and he washed it up, and he started to overdose. And as he was starting to overdose, I remember at the time thinking, this is a fucking real inconvenience. Like, this is it's spoiling my buzz, because I kept coming up with taking our pipe, and then he was like, oh God, I've got to deal with this. And so anyway, after, because, I mean, it's just the self-centeredness, isn't it, and of addiction is just, it knows no bounds, really, isn't it? Like, So he overdosed. Anyway, the long and short of it, I decided, I'd slapped him around and phone cold water and all the rest of it. And then he sort of started to come around, and I thought, yeah, brilliant, I can go back upstairs, smoke some pipes and drink the rest of the tequila. So that's what I'd done, went upstairs, and then I crashed out. But as I was crashing out, it was really significant. It was a real significant voice in my head saying, go down, Mark, and check your friend. Go down and check. It was really, like, strong. But because I was, like, so out of it, I just sort of ignored it. And I fell asleep. And I woke up in the morning, and I came downstairs, and he had a dog. He had an Alsatian dog. And I went into the room, and the place was washed. But Sonny, I didn't know Sonny was still, had been there, right? So I thought there was no one else in the house. And I came into the room, and they'd put a quilt, a little blanket on top of his face, and so I pulled the blanket back, and he'd asphyxiated, he choked on his vomit. And I remember thinking, at the time, I just freaked out. I just went, oh my God, because I realised he is dead, you know, he's sort of dead. And so I ran back upstairs, had another pipe. It's like, because this is what it's like. I was like, a pipe, ran around the room, got a bottle, found a bottle of wine, a whole bottle of wine hadn't been opened. And I just clogged it all back, came back downstairs. Now, and then I went through this whole thing of getting all the drugs out of the house, and I started to blackmail, right? So the dealer who gave me it, I phoned him up right away, and I says, listen, we've got a problem. You've got a problem. You've got a problem. It's a big problem, because Walsh is my friend's dead, and you're responsible for it, really. I says, get up here now. And he came up, and he was like standing there, and he had crocodile tears, and I slapped him, and I says, don't be, you know. And but the long and short of it, for years I thought that I had found Walsh, and nobody else, but Sonny had been in the house before, and he found his body, and so he'd already seen that he was dead, you know. And he reminded me of an important part of the whole story, because I was stuck between the IRA and LA people were really keen to know, because they were really keen on my friend, and they were saying, tell us the guy who gave him the heroin. And because I was blackmailing the dealer, I didn't want to, you know, so I just thought, no, I can't, you know, I don't know who it is. I just would go like that, I don't know who it is. And they would be like, well, you must know, you know who, you came to your party. And at the same time, I was going to the heroin dealer, and I was going, Tokes, there's some heavy-duty fucking people that want to have a word with you, and if you don't keep on giving me the heroin, I'll have to tell them. And that just sums up. It sums up for me addiction. That's where it talks about it in our literature. We're reduced to an animal level, and that's what I was like. It was like a feral animal. Do you know what I mean? And then there's another saying that we say in NA that, you know, when any man or woman enters the doors of Narcotics Anonymous, the heavens fall silent and God listens, because a human being's dignity is about to be restored. Mm. And that's what happens. We come in here and our dignity is restored, our self-respect, and, you know, and but we've also got an addiction. We've got an ongoing addiction that we have to deal with. Now, so for newcomers and stuff, and for people in the fellowship, when I came in initially, I don't think it really matters that much, Penny, because it's still...
Do you want to hold it?
Okay, well, I don't know. It looks like I'm Frank Sinatra now, just about to do fucking blue eyes. What you want? That's life. Right, okay. It's weird. I'm sure... Okay, I think they can. Oh, okay, up the back. Yeah. Yeah, cool, right. So when I came in, I thought it was just about the drugs, right? Obviously, I mean, that's what we all come in, and this is not to frighten any newcomers. Please believe me, it is about the drugs, and it always is about the drugs and the alcohol, but it's much more than the drugs. So if the addiction, if we look at what is the illness, we talk about the illness all the time or the disease. I've never really liked the word disease, but I like illness. Thanks, Dean. So what's the illness? It's just needs Viagra severely. Right. Okay. Cheers, Dean. Thank you. And so the illness is right. So the drugs and alcohol are like that, and the illness is like that. Right. So what are the symptoms? What are the other symptoms of the illness? And for me, it's many, it's multifaceted. First, I'm self-obsessed, right? There's no doubt about it. So clean, forget the fucking, you know, like Gary talks about this all the time, that we're obsessed with self, you know, when we're young, and then we take the drugs, and then we're obsessed with the drugs, and then we get clean, and then we become obsessed with self. So it's like that. I'm the first person I think about when I wake, open my eyes in the morning, and it continues that way, really, for most of the day. It doesn't really alter that much. But now I'm in, I've got a few, and I'll tell you a story. Listen, 2 years ago I'd done the share here 2 years ago, and my fiance was, Amy, sitting just across there, and we met, and now we're engaged, right? And I mean, I'm just saying there's hope, really, for, you know, for recovery. So far, so good. But, and she's beautiful, and I love being with her. And so what is it? The symptoms are far more, they're self-obsession, I'm hypersensitive, right? I've got a non-stop mind that just chatters shit most of the time, and it creates stories. And Mark Twain once said, I've gone through many terrible things in my life, most of which never happened. And that is it. That is it. That is, he was fucking definitely an addict, I think. Because, you know, what does my brain do from the moment I open my eyes? If I'm not obsessed with self, I'm obsessed that someday that Amy's going to leave me. You know, it's just a matter of time. So as soon as I open my eyes in the morning, I look across and I think, she's beautiful. She's sure to leave me. This is just a matter of time. It's a waiting game, you know what I mean? Make the most of this, because it's not going to last. Right? That's what the head says. It's like continual fucking shit, really. And how do you counteract that voice is that I know from Yuzga. Yeah, sorry?
Maria.
Maria, yeah, definitely. And have lots of children, maybe, and that secures it. There's this thing, so the illness is always sort of operating. Now, of course, when I first came in, it was definitely drugs and alcohol. I could not stop using, without a shadow of doubt. I was rock bottom. I had all the money from drug dealing, all that, all the things that I used to do to get money, smuggling, drug dealing, was all gone. All the money was gone, and I was a street addict, really, on the street, desperate, came in, to the fellowship, well, came into rehab, and I want to say about rehab, thank God for rehab, thank God for state NHS funding, thank fucking God, man, we live in a country. I've been in Peru and places like that where you're snookered, man. See if you've got drugs, if you've got an addiction, they just lock you up in psychiatric, which they used to do here in the 60s, really, and so thank God we've got a system in Britain that, you know, I really mean that, it's so important. So I went there and I had a therapist, and the therapist that I had was a guy called Tony, I was going to say his second name, but I'm not going to say, but he said, I knew a wee bit about his family. He came from a really rough family in Glasgow. Some of them were doing bank robberies, and I thought, God, if he can get clean, I can get clean, if he can stay sober. And he used to say to me, and I'll never forget it, the thing in rehab, isn't it? They always go, well, they used to say in our rehab anyway, used to go, look to your left, because the person on the left's going to be dead, and look to your right, because the one on the right's going to be in the madness, it's going to be in the illness. What do you, you know, and where are you going to be? And you know what's really funny for me is, even although he was like saying to me, I remember he used to do lectures about addiction, and he'd say things like, well, there's some people that just really wind up addicted, but they're not really addicts, right? There's some people that are just sort of like, they've just stumbled upon it, they've taken prescription drugs for backache or something, they've wound up with a habit, really, but they're not really addicts. And then there's people who are total addicts. And I used to sit there and I used to think, yeah, I'm not really an addict. I'm fucking... And he used to say, Mark, you were sticking fucking copious amounts of heroin in your body, cutting through customs. You were going through into Thailand and Malaysia, where it's the death penalty. You shared with people who were HIV positive. You're fucking nuts. You are an addict. And I'd be still, and that's the illness. The illness is sitting there trying to, like, coerce me. And that's how it works. How I believe the illness works in me is it tries to coerce me back out the door, and it uses every strategy possible. It is so, and this is why I'm saying for the newcomers as well, this is so powerful, this illness. But this, what we've got also, is incredibly powerful, more powerful than that. That's why we're all here, because look, we're all, every one of us, we're here, and we shouldn't really be, I mean, most of us shouldn't be here, really, we should be dead. But yet, we all are still clean, by coming on a daily or a weekly basis to a few meetings, I mean, or several meetings. And I'd done all of it, the 90 and 90. I'd done a meeting for a year. I was just like, I just thought, there is no way I want to go back. So if you're a newcomer and you're just new to the fellowship, please do loads of meetings. And what I'm saying here is just stuff that I've picked up through the years and stuff. If you don't like what I've said, there's loads of other meetings, and you'll hear your share sometime. You'll hear actually somebody talking about your message, your story, and it was mad when I get into the rehab. He said, look, you have to have absolute respect for this illness, and if you don't have respect for it, it will kill you. It's as simple as that. And he says, and it will continually morph into something else. It morphs. Now, I know my addiction. I've wound up in a lot of different... I came in here just thinking, of course, not, you know, like this NA. And I'm not saying... This fellowship deals with addiction, full stop, right? So it covers every different thing. But I've also, in the time, because I'm mad codependent, and I've dealt with sex addiction, sex and love addiction, because I'm a love addict, you know. So I've had to do a lot of work. I've had to do steps in those programs, and which is all, and lots and lots of therapy throughout the years. And so the illness has a mission. So the illness's mission is not necessarily to kill me, not necessarily to get me to use the drugs or alcohol, but the illness can also just keep me small, and it uses a lot of ways to do that. So I really notice in my work, say for example, like there's lots of things that I could do, and I could do projects, and I could do like lots more, really, right? But my illness uses procrastination. It's the defects of character that gets to pick up, you know. So in step 6 and 7, I wish I had more time to talk about them, but in 6 and 7, it says in the literature as well, defects will get us into a corner we cannot get out of. So the illness can keep me small, can keep me believing. So if I believe, if I'm isolated, now this is, if I'm isolated and I'm not going to meetings, then the illness will creep, will get stronger. I really believe, in this 20 years, also I believe my illness has got stronger. It's doing press-ups. But what I've done is I've continued to be willing, like as I said about the willingness, and I've continued to be willing to change. And it also says in the literature, without sounding like, I sound like a fucking literature boffin, but I'm not really, but I just remember lots of stuff. It requires a nuclear blast to change, it says in there. It shows you how stubborn we can be, that we just don't want to change, really. There's a part of it, well, I'm talking about myself, that it takes a lot to get me to change. And So basically, I applied myself, and I started to do the steps and stuff. And there's a thing, and what's really important is my will, because sometimes I think that it can get a bad press, the will can get a bad press in the fellowship, but my will also, in recovery, has done a lot of good stuff, because I've applied the willfulness of that, because I'm really willful, but if I just focus that on a productive thing, I can do really well. But it's when the will is focused on something destructive. So if it's focused on gambling or sex addiction or you know, like criminality or stuff that's destructive for me, that's when I've got a problem. So I started to do that, and what spurred me on to do my first step 4 and 5 was really, it was a wee guy from New York, from Harlem, came, and he said that really I thought was a brilliant thing. This is 1997. He says if you get into a relationship and you've not done a step 4 and 5, you've got 6 people in the relationship. You've got who you think you are, who she thinks you are, and who you actually are. And she's got who she thinks she is, who she actually is, and who you think she is. And he says, that's 6 people. The 2 wrong ones always show up. It's fucked, right? And I remember, so that was the inspiration. So even although I think I'm doing the right thing for the right reasons, there's always other agendas going on, right? There's always this unconscious desire that, oh, right, I can secure a really nice girlfriend. Now I'm clean and da-da-da, I can get a recovery girlfriend, you know, like... So that's what was sort of going on with that. And then I'd done the 4 and 5, the 6 and 7. I started to make amends. Just to go back a wee bit, what I've realised is that the step, you know, like step one and stuff, and where I see the step one is that I see I am completely powerless over drugs, and I'm powerless before I take drugs as well. I can see that clearly, right? There's two, I'm screwed up both ways, but I also can see that I'm powerless over a lot of my thoughts. I'm powerless over my first thought, but I'm not powerless over what I do then to change my thought. So if I'm getting sort of negative thoughts, I can apply the step 2 and 3 and go, right, okay, I hand this, I'm nuts. Basically, I say, I'm nuts. See, I don't even know, really, to tell you the truth, guys, I don't think I get restored to sanity, really. I think I'm still mad, right? And in case you've not guessed, right? But I think what it is, when I come in here and I hear lots of other people mad as well, it makes me not feel isolated. I think, oh God, they're nuts as well. Thank God. You know, thank God they're nuts and they're madder than me. So I feel at home, right? And I think that's what it really is, because I just watch my thoughts. Even I can do this and walk out of here and just have such nutty, you know, nutty thoughts that just come from nowhere. So I do that, and the step 3 is that I hand my will and my life over to the program. That the program has to be my priority. It has to come above all things. Whatever I prioritize, and I mean by that is, like, I guess it's like, you know, if people who have got diabetes, say somebody has got an illness and they've got diabetes, if they've got diabetes, so 2 people could look at it. One person could go, I've got diabetes, I'm going to get fat, I'm fat, and I'm going to lose limbs eventually, and I'm going to get so out of shape, and I can't use sugar, and right? But then someone else can go, okay, I've got diabetes. What I'm going to do is I'm going to really watch my diet now. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to train every day, and I'm going to be an Ironman. Sorry, I'm going to be an Ironman champion. And they can just go, right, this is what I'm going to do. And if I do that, if that's the way that I tackle my illness, I've got, right, okay, I've got this illness, but I've got a recovery program, and I'm going to really work this the best of my ability. And I make being in recovery and being a recovering addict, don't have to announce it to lots of people and whatever, but I make that a central theme of my identity. I make that, that's what I really need to do to live my life. Then I will... I'll be okay. I'll be really okay, because I'll use the social net, I'll use NA, I'll use all my friends, my networks, and my sponsor, and I'll do all the stuff that I need to do. But if I go, oh yeah, I've got an illness, and da-da-da, you know, and don't put the work in, I'm in trouble. And it is, you see the wildlife programs all the time, you see the wildebeest, you know, like you see the lions fucking just waiting, man, and the wildebeest are just starting to stray. And as soon as that wildebeest strays a wee bit too far, bang, it's fucking on, and the lion's on it. And that's the way I see the illness. And because both of my friends, both, at 14 years and at 10 years are dead, and they're dead because of the addiction morphing into other things, morphing into sex addiction, morphing into gambling. They both picked up a drink. They both stopped going to meetings. It happens all the time. You see it, like, they go, oh, well, I don't really, I'm a therapist. Here's another one, too, because what they used to say is, and I was talking to Russell about this earlier on, in Bournemouth they used to say, well, if you work in the field, because I'm a therapist, if you work in the field, you don't need to go to meetings because you're hearing the sickness all the time in the rooms, you know, like, you don't, because you're getting it reinforced. I think you need more meetings because you're around the fucking madness all the time. And I've seen many a person who thinks, I don't need, because I'm listening to people all day, I need more because I need to hear the solution. I need to be around people who are positive or inspirational. Now, I'm just aware that my time's sort of just about to run out, and I think it's really good to be, I was at five, right, that's cool. I want to talk about what's happened to me this week, because it's really important to be completely authentic about my stepdad died yesterday, and it was a real shock because I was So what happened is my stepdad died and my mum phoned me up and we started to have a conversation on the phone, and I realised she was in massive denial, and she'd just been sitting beside the hospital bed, and I phoned her up. I didn't know, he'd only went into hospital the day before. Now, this man was also an alcoholic. My mother was a codependent, my father was an alcoholic, my grandfather we used to have a joke in Scotland, alcoholism doesn't run in our family, it gallops. It's like fucking, it's like if I look at the family tree, it's just full, and it's not just been a Glaswegian or Scottish, but I think it's just my particular family. And my mother had been in a codependent relationship with my father, and then she divorced my father and she met this other man who was a more refined alcoholic, right? Right. But the thing is, and I really honour this man, Bill, right? I really honour him, but what happened is he was 6 o'clock at night. He would, you know, it was like, what happened? 6 o'clock at night, wouldn't drink all day, but as soon as 6 o'clock came, bang, the whiskey was out. And so yesterday when I phoned her, she was beside the bed, and I could see that I spoke to her, and she was making it as if he was still alive. And then it was my stepbrother got on the phone and says, actually, Mark, he's just died. He's died 30 minutes ago. So what recovery has gave me, right? It gives me the ability to be there, right? To really be there. Now, my mum was, fuck, you know, I was in jail in Spain for smuggling. Years ago, I was in jail in Spain. My mother used to be contacting her, send me the money to bail, and I'll get out here. Always, like, asking my mother for stuff, right? She would always give it, right? And but this gives me, recovery gives me the opportunity to be really present, to really be there and hold whatever is going on for her, and trying to be really, because she's going to be completely screwed up. And what it also reminds me of, and it taps into this thing, is like, and I'll finish on this, like my, a couple of years ago, and it's a real good indicator of the illness, like a couple of years ago, 4 years ago, my dad died. My dad died sober, right? I 12-stepped my dad into the fellowship. So, it was brilliant. And the thing is, so my cousin's also in the fellowship. So what happened is, I got my dad got sober, he got 16 years, he got 14 years. And he died. He just died one night, just right out of the blue. And as I was going up to his house, I thought, I'm going to go up there, and the family wanted me to do the eulogy. Now, honest to God, right, if that had happened years ago, there is no way the family would have wanted me anywhere near a eulogy. You know, like in my using, they would just be like, keep him well away. You know, it's like, you know, but anyway, they wanted me to do the eulogy, and I got up, and this is exactly how the illness works for me, right? I've not even told you, there's some other story. I've had mad stories. I was kidnapped when I was 5 years clean in Peru, like, just clean, just, and fucking, because I'm such a mad head sometimes, but I've not got time to get into that. But anyway, when I was going up with my dad's, right, I said to my aunt, I says, listen, I don't want you to change the sheets on his bed, please. And I just knew in truth, like, keep the sheets the way it was when he died. And as I was walking into his house, I had my laptop. Now, I'm porn free. I've not looked at porn now for 18 months. I do a lot of work in that. So anyway, as I was walking into his house and the laptop, my head, the addiction said, open up the laptop, because the feelings was going, look at some porn, look at, you know, to me, and I actually started to do it. And then I was sitting there in the living room and I thought, And it's cool. And then what I'd done was I just closed it down. I closed it. I just went like that. Just get off of this shit, man. Because it's soul destroying stuff for me. I mean, some people maybe can use a bit of porn, they're okay, but I get stuck. I get stuck with it, right? But anyway, I am. Sounds not. That's not the best thing. Stuck's not the right word. But you know what I'm getting at. But I closed it and I went into the bed. And as soon as I get into the bed and I smell his scent on the sheets, I went right into the trite, I went right into the loss and the grief, and I started to fucking cry, and and that's what I was there to do. That's where I was meant to be, and I'd done the eulogy the next day, and I came out of that eulogy, and I'm telling you, I was so buzzing. I mean, I was like, you nailed it. You just like, you, because my father was a criminal and all this stuff, and you know, and he was sober, and I'd just done this amazing eulogy, and this is the joys of recovery. And beyond the limitations of my imagination, when I came in, I could not imagine even getting one day clean. I couldn't imagine the limitation. I was so restricted. I thought, oh God, how could I give up? How could I even get one day clean? And my life is just, because Narcotics Anonymous has shown me that, you know, dare to dream, right? Keep dreaming and just put the action in, face your fear and keep moving through it. And that, thank you for letting me share. Cheers.